Hey everyone, welcome to Gods of Eden. I'm really excited to be back for season 4, and I'm super appreciative that I'm starting the season with someone as amazing as Alex Holmes. Alex is a man of many, many talents. He has his own podcast, his own newsletter. He works with people around emotional resiliency, and most recently became a published author with his book, Time to Talk. I have a great amount of respect for the man that Alex is, and around the work that he does. He has a fantastic platform that shares conversations around men's mental health, which of course I greatly resonates with me. And I love the way he goes about his work with such empathy and consideration. And he's also a very deep thinker, which is something that I've been intrigued by. And I was able to pick his mind and hear about his journey, which is something that once again, I'm very appreciative of. You can find out everything that Alex has got going on through the show notes that you can see below. If you do like the episode, please subscribe. Please leave a rating if you're listening to this on Apple. And without further ado, here's the episode. 3, 2, 1, let's go. Hey Alex, how are you doing?
Hey man, I'm good. How are you doing, Luca?
I'm doing very well. I'm loving this sun, and I'm loving that you've got a window near you. You can kind of glance out as well.
You know, I recently moved my room around. I flipped it. It wasn't by the window for so long. My bed was here, and I just thought to myself, why has it taken me so long to move my desk and my workspace to the window? Because I can people watch and daydream and watch the many movements and many lives of cats as I want, without feeling as if I'm really just not doing the work I'm supposed to be doing, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just so fun just to see the everyday lives of the people on my street in their gardens. Gardens always tell you so much more than the front of the house, you know?
Completely agree.
As well. So I am very good. And it's just nice being right by the window. I can daydream as well. And it's wonderful. I was previously in the corner and there wasn't much, there wasn't a window there. So it's actually very good.
I'm a big daydreamer, so I heavily, heavily connect with that kind of letting your mind wander and do what it needs to do. So I'm a big
fan. For sure. Shout out the daydreamers.
Yep, big shout out to the daydreamers. I'm a big fan. That's how this has started.
Wonderful.
Right, so my first question. Alex, can you give me a song that makes you happy or reminds you of a good memory?
I saw this question and I'm a huge audiophile, like music, podcasts, audiobooks, conversations. They really inspire me. And one of the songs that really just popped in my mind straight away, and I'm surprised it wasn't a Barris Hamlin song, but I'm sticking true to authenticity here. And it's Luther Vandross.
Oh.
Can You Take Me Out?
Oh.
Can I Take You Out Tonight? Or I think it's called Take You Out Tonight, yeah. And that is one of those songs that really, it does so much. It encapsulates positive masculinity and a healthy masculinity and asking somebody out on a date. And it also reminds me of summertime. Mm-hmm. It reminds me of a beautiful man in Luther Vandross and the way that he kind of portrayed love and got people to really experience and evaluate love as well. And, you know, people may not recognize how important it is to see men singing.
Yeah.
That is a real, real kind of revolutionary thing, because especially black men, because as much as, you know, black people are full of soul and outside of the church, it's always looked at when you see black men, it's usually just the whole, it's rap or something pertaining to urban culture. And when we see men singing, black men singing, it just comes from such a place. And when they're singing love, about love and about relationships, it just makes it that much more insightful and intuitive. So I love that song. Take You Out by Luther Vandross is the song that always makes me smile, always gets me in my feelings. And it's not hard, really, for me to get in my feelings. So yeah, that's not really saying much, but it's definitely on a long list of mine that I have of songs that just have made up my life so far.
I love it. That's great. So the reason I've asked you that is because I have a Spotify playlist, which is the Guards of Eden soundtrack. And it's kind of, I think, just like you, I'm a big big audiophile, and that this idea of like that song kind of has a mini representation of that person. And yeah, it's just a chronological kind of just a place where each song represents a person, and it kind of becomes a playlist. So that will be your song, and that will be added to the Spotify playlist. And I absolutely love everything about the reasoning, because it's a lot of the reason why you're here and why I've been so excited about having this conversation with you. So thank you very much. That will live there, and that playlist will live in the show notes.
Amazing.
Awesome. So my first real question is, can you speak to your childhood in terms of how do you remember it, and are there any early memories that really stick out to you about it?
It's so funny. I had a conversation with this with one of my best friends recently. And even on my podcast, I spoke to a psychologist about why we forget parts of our childhoods. And it's usually, you know, to do with trauma and, you know, blocking out the traumatic moments. So there are real gaps in our memories as well. But I remember quite a lot of my childhood, actually. But the one thing that I would say is really, really sticks out is death. In my family, it was a lot of death that really kind of laced my childhood. Starting with the death of my grandmother when I was 6, and then my grandfather when I was 14, then my aunt when I was around 10, my uncle, more recently my uncle, and then my grandmother, and again my maternal grandmother. But it was a lot to do with death and about learning how we survive after death.
Yeah,
was a huge impact on my childhood. But I also, we also, but I know, but it's usually the creation and the ending of life, you know. Like, I remember a lot of my younger cousins being born. I remember a lot of my siblings being born. Mm. I remember long summer holidays. I think that it's weird to think that childhood is just a series of long summers.
Yeah.
Really and truly. And then as you grow older, they just become shorter and shorter and shorter. And then you are literally living for like the few weeks that you feel you have. And, you know, I spend a lot of my time trying to reclaim that, right? Trying to reconnect back to what that means to have, to explore time and how we can make it last longer. What we've got, but, you know, I remember so many different things. It's hard to pinpoint down one memory. Like, I remember spending a lot of time with my grandparents and learning from them, being so in awe by them and their majesty and just the way that they acted. And a lot of time I spent with my cousins and my siblings, family parties, family functions, which, you know, has been kind of all put on hold since the pandemic now.
Yeah.
Being together, the last big family party/function we had was my grandmother's funeral in 2019.
Yeah.
And you probably think, oh, why is that a party sort of thing? But, you know, we've always considered death as a celebration. And while we do mourn, and we are mourning the loss of somebody who was so dear to us, we celebrate their life and we really remember it and go, because if we celebrated it and it was just a kind of morbid or really down experience, and it wouldn't do them any justice. It would be a bit more of a reflection of their life in that sense. But yeah, I think that there's so much in my childhood. It's so hard to pinpoint something down, but
yeah,
grief is something that was a huge theme for me growing up.
Do you think that's impact, because it's been so prevalent and present throughout your, you know, through a young age and kind of as you've grown older, the idea of death, do you think it's encouraged you to change either your perception or relationship with death, whereas you maybe wouldn't have had to have changed it in a certain way if you hadn't experienced it kind of consistently as you've grown up? Because you've mentioned, it's something that you've experienced from like a toddler age, but also, you know, preteen, teen, and now as a man, has it forced you to kind of consistently reevaluate like your own relationship with the idea of death and life consequently because of that?
I think I'm just somebody who's so empathetic and a deep thinker and feeler. Like, I'm a deep, deep feeler. I guess it just wisened me up to understanding what that is, you know, in comparison to a lot of my family members or friends even. Death, like anything, shocks people, shocks me. It shocks anyone. Because and we've recently suffered a tragedy recently as well in our family.
I'm sorry to hear that.
It's okay. But death always shocks, like, because you never know when it's coming. But it's the kind of the dealing with it and what happens and how we kind of move through it, which is important. And because I had that exposure to things so young, and the family I had were very kind of explicit about being together and connected and working together and kind of moving through our emotions as one unit, it helped me understand the emotional impact of grief a lot more. So I don't know, I'm happy that I experienced those things early, because it also meant that when it came to dealing with friends who have suicide ideation, it meant that I could kind of tap into how I could be there for them in that space. When it came to friends losing people, I really understood how I could show up for them in their grieving. And it just kind of prepares me, just mentally and emotionally, just for when the inevitable comes, because it just makes me just really think about the briefness of life. Like, life is so short. And we don't talk about death enough. As a culture, we don't talk about death enough, because so many cultures, especially the indigenous cultures and, you know, the Afro-spiritual and Indo-spiritual and Sino-spiritual, and we're very, very concerned with death, not as a form of fear, but as a natural part of what life is and what life continues to be. You know, it's that balance that works. We see life and death every day. Every season we see something dying and growing and dying again, and I just think that it's just time we kind of spoke about a lot of different about death and how we navigate it, especially how we navigate it as men as well.
One thing that you have spoken about is this idea of being sensitive and empathetic, and you've alluded to it there. How would you say, because it's something that I quite relate to, and I think it's probably, as I look back now, I've kind of had to reframe a couple of experiences that I don't know if they were traumatic as much, but they were experiences now that I look back and I realize it was because of the way I was and maybe the discomfort people had with me being that way, whether it was, you know, not hyper-masculine or being a deep thinker, like you said, and being a bit more empathetic and sensitive. But I was wondering if you can speak to how that maybe would have impacted you as you were kind of finding yourself as a teenager and a young man, this idea of being someone that was a bit more sensitive, a bit more introverted in terms of, yeah, just being a deep thinker. I think it comes with a lot of in terms of labels, mischaracteristics in terms of how people perceive you. And I was wondering if you can speak to being that way inclined and how it would have impacted you growing up.
Yeah, so I was prone to anxiety as a child. And the thing is, it wasn't always the case. It was, I wasn't always an anxious child. It was, again, it was the result of a traumatic loss. And the shifting of my understanding of what, of my childhood, and the nature of how that can really show up in altering the parental relationship with the child and the sibling relationship and that extended familial relationship, that all shifted on its head. And there was a process of growing into more difficulty. And I became more and more anxious because emotions were on the rise. People hadn't dealt with grief in the ways that they could, and they didn't have the opportunity to do so in the best ways. And all while children are growing up, trying to understand themselves, understand the world, understand nature, and their lives have been changed, and you know, the adults around us have, you know, aren't emotionally regulating themselves in ways that are healthy because they don't know how. So there was a huge collective grief there in that kind of space, and that's what created this idea of the anxious me, me being anxious and kind of struggling with my own kind of perspective of showing up and understanding what masculinity was for me. It was it impacted my kind of experiences as a teenager, just because, you know, when you are, you don't, as a teen, you don't know anything, but you think you know everything. And you do think you know that everything is the be all and end all, really and truly. You think you have this infinite wisdom when you generally do not, clearly, because of your age and your life experience, you just don't have it. You think that you've lost enough people, and it's just consistently sad, you know. Going through school and having lost my aunt, my granddad, a cousin, it was just all kind of like a lot at one time, but I still had to get on with the business of being a teenager and get on with the business of doing life, and, you know, couldn't really wallow around and be upset, and it was just strange. And as a teenager, you know, like, and then that did make me more sympathetic and kind of more empathetic to people. So I was in a lot of environments, and like where I was doing a lot of the more empathetic work. You know, I kind of did a lot of things to work with a lot of different pupils in my year group. I mentored years below me. I did a lot of these kind of different things because I was so, at the time I didn't realize this, but looking back on it, I was looking for a way to nurture. And specifically, I was looking for a way to nurture other men, other boys, because I just noticed that we weren't having and weren't getting the nurturing that we so needed. And so craved. A lot of boys are just left to their own devices with their emotions and their emotionality. They have to just get on with it. They should just understand that that is just not something that they need to be literate in. but because I was gentle, because I was caring, because I was nurturing, I was deemed as not masculine because I loved R&B music, because I loved slow jams and emotional songs, and because I read a lot, and I really tapped into people's stories, and I loved to share. I used to love to watch dramas and not so much action. It was just like, they were like, you know, it was just, oh, you're not like us. You're not a real guy. You're someone else, and you're a good guy, quote unquote. Mm. In my head, I used to be like, nothing wrong with being a good guy. But I know the political, you know, issues of being a good guy nowadays is just, and that's just what I've come to learn. But when people use the words in terms like good guy and not a real man, like side by side, they are simultaneously just like diminishing your identity and your self-worth and understanding of yourself as well.
Yeah.
So, I didn't have this, all these myths and all these things that I thought I had to live up to, all these things, I just wasn't there. Like, it just wasn't for me. I felt like I had to conform to that.
Yeah.
And one thing I've not been very good at doing well is conforming. It was a process. It was a struggle. But we thank the universe, thank God, thank Creator that kind of got through that and kind of made it through to kind of adulthood where I could explore and understand all of these things and what these things meant for myself.
Yeah, there's almost this air of like, it's like an out body experience, like hearing you go through that, because it's anybody that knows me, it's like extremely similar to who I am, and my experience is probably one of the main reasons I've been drawn to you. But it's this idea of, yeah, spending a lot of my preteen years, my teen years, my young adult years being told that because I wasn't this like typical man, which of course that's problematic enough as it is, but this idea of what a society's idea of what a man should be, that yeah, you end up having to adapt on the fly in terms of fitting into your surroundings just to, yeah, just as a way of like self-preservation almost, in this idea of, if I just, you know, act like a man, massively in quotations, I can get through this, and, you know, this person won't give me so much trouble or grief. And yeah, so to hear that is like, it's so strange to hear someone almost with like my exact perception and a lot of my story, but just cannot wholeheartedly agree enough with the way that you kind of perceive it and just your life in general. I love the fact you're a deep thinker. It makes for this conversation to be just so much fun. But I do want to deter you to something that's very serious, which is 2021. We're hoping and touching wood that the summer's going to be a bit more normal. Are you going to be in the streets of Notting Hill for Carnival this year? And can you speak to your love of Notting Hill Carnival?
I want to get my second dose of the vaccine so that I have the choice to go. I had my first dose already, so I'm waiting for my second dose.
Great.
And I want to be in the streets of Notting Hill Carnival with my foot in the air and my rum in somewhere.
Yeah.
And my rum somewhere, my flag flying behind me as I run down Notting Hill Gate. That's basically what I want to be doing. Whether London want to allow Carnival to commence or recommence again, ever, is another question.
Mm.
But I love Carnival.
Yeah, Carnival, can you speak to it? Because I heard you I heard you speak about it in an interview, and it just hearing your voice like completely change, and the passion you spoke for it, I was like, I definitely need to hear about this.
Carnival is a love letter to my soul. Every year I find myself just in the street for 2 days dancing to my birthright. The real history of what it means to be a West Indian in this in the UK, but also the deep connectivity to the, as I said earlier, about the indigenous experience of what it means to be Black in Britain. And I look forward to Carnival more than I look forward to Christmas. And it was just always, just by the time, I remember I always used to book a week off work. And I used to kind of like, I was like, yeah, it's Carnival time. I used to prep the bank holiday weekend and then just spend the week after Carnival just in a deep grief before I went back to work. I was like, it's over. It just makes it such a special event, man. It just means, because it's all of the Caribbean cultures in one place. It's the soca, it's the zouk, it's the dance hall, it's the vibrancy, it's the patties being sold on the corner, it's the people getting curry goat and festival and fish and all of that stuff, and it's the flags from every country, like not even just the Caribbean, just every country just there and just vibing out to having a great time on the road. And it becomes more of a, I go there with my friends and it's a communal thing. It's just an element of joy, really. It's the one time you get out and you can express why you love the summer so much.
Yeah.
And I am still wanting to go and experience it in the Caribbean, which was my plan for 2020. Yeah. However, 2020 had its own ideas about what it wanted for me. So, but yeah, I mean, like, I'm just excited to even have the opportunity to have experienced Carnival in the way that I've experienced it growing up. I've been at a carnival every single year since I was like 10.
Wow.
I remember my first time going to Carnival and being just among the crowds and the music, and it was just a beautiful time. Yeah, like, it's just amazing, and I love it so much. It's just a time for me just to let loose and really say goodbye to the summer and welcome in the autumn. I'm a big believer in that humans, regardless of your race and your ethnicity and your culture, we are such ritualistic people. And we mark seasons and moments in ways that that are so inherent to us that we've forgotten how connected we are to these times. You know, we've got Easter coming up soon, and it's a time for family and things like that. But we also mark it by the changing of the clocks, British summertime entering into a new phase of time, essentially. We look at it as the kind of beginning of a new harvest and what that looks like for the rest of the time up until October. You know, we do all of that, and then we are a part of the rituals that we have, and we don't speak about that. We don't really connect that up together. And I think that it's just important that we do.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. Hearing you talk about Carnival is just enriching of the soul, man.
What's your background, Luca?
Oh, so really confusing. So half Spanish. Half Spanish, a bit Irish and English, but the last name Spanish. My mum had a crush on the he was coming to Chelsea the year that she was pregnant with me, which was Gianluca Vialli, the Chelsea football player/manager. Saw him on TV, said to my dad, "Who's that?" Gianluca. So that's where the Italian name comes from. But yeah, so Spanish, Irish, which is why, I've got this, you know, I'm pale as anything, but can grow this ridiculous sized beard, which has been a fixture of lockdown. But yeah, that's it really in terms of kind of culturally, but yeah, I think the Notting Hill Carnival, I want to go really badly, was another reason why I asked you, because it is something that I'm yet to do, but really there's a bit of regret in the fact I haven't done it earlier. So I'm very excited and hoping that, I'm hoping 2021 gives us that. At the very least, you know?
At the very least.
Yeah, because 2020 was such a bitch.
The least you could do.
Yeah, exactly. After last year, you know, give us that. Mm-hmm. So one of the big reasons that we're talking around this time is because, spoiler alert, you're going to be an author. The book's going to be out, right? When this comes out.
The book is out, yeah.
As you're hearing this Alex's book is out. When do you remember picking up your love for reading and literature? And do you remember an early book that really stuck with you that kind of was like a wood on the fire? It like fueled the passion, as it were.
Yeah. Love for reading. Reading was my best friend before I even really understood what friendship was, to be fair. Like, I just was in books all the time. It was just me, my stories, and that was it. As I said, your childhood is a series of long summers, and you are just having summers where you are just reading, and it's wonderful. It's just an amazing it is an amazing experience. I'm still waiting for my Hogwarts letter.
Oh.
And that is where I really found my tribe.
Right.
In my Hogwarts experience. I love young adult fiction. I have a deep, like, I mean, I mean, when you have to be an adult and read adult stuff, you're just like, okay, fine, whatever. It does what it does. But I was deep in Harry Potter series. I was deep in Lord of the Rings. I was deep in, I don't know if you've heard of the Children of the Red King series. It's by Charlie Bone.
Oh, no.
I loved that. I forgot what the collective series, his Dark Materials series, the Northern Lights, the Amber Spyglass, and the Subtle Knife, and I was just in awe of just young adult fiction, and the beauty with the young adult fiction is that you have the opportunity to really tap into what it means to be a young person and a child. Going through such heavy and emotional topics in life, but also reminding adults of this fact.
Yeah.
And beautiful. I lived in young adult fiction, and then until I felt like I had to grow up, and I started going into crime fiction, and I thought, ooh, all right, enough of the spells and the enchanted doors that lead you to everywhere else in the world. Let's talk about crime. So I went into crime fiction, and I read a lot of Harlan Coben, Linwood Barclay. What's his name? Is it James Brown? Is it James Brown? I forgot what his name is, but the guy who read the Alex Cross series. I read a lot of their stuff, and I just. Yeah, man, I was with the crime. I was with it, like, you know, trying to find out who did what and like get to the end of the story and the realities and the humanness of it all, and the stories of like a father who lost his wife, but then his daughter went missing, and that emotional turmoil of trying to find out who last saw her, how he found her, all of that stuff, trying to really dig into what that was. Or the sports star who was caught up in a huge scandal, but you know, it goes deeper than it just being the scandal. It's this really underground kind of stuff that's going on, and they just happen to get caught up in. Love that stuff. Love a complex storyline, love a mystery, love a fantasy, love all of it. So that's what really kind of pulled me to reading, and I just like I just found my tribe, man, my community in it.
Yeah, there's one book that I have as a recommendation that you've probably read, but it actually gives me a nice transition to my next question. But I read it studying English when I was at A level, and it is called In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
In what, sorry?
In Cold Blood.
In Cold Blood, okay.
Which is two guys, it's a real story, but two guys go, it's like a botched robbery where it ends up that they commit murder with a family. They don't realize the family's in. But the book is about him getting to know the two people that are committed of it, and they are on death row. But he's a journalist in real life and gets to know them and kind of, yeah, I won't spoil it, but yeah, it's just really interesting him describing not only the events of the crime, but actually like the personal attachment he ends up developing in terms of like an affinity for one of them. It's so strange, but it's, yeah, great read. So that might scratch an itch in terms of the crime. It almost feels fantasy, but I believe it's to be true. So, yeah, there's one for you.
Okay, In Cold Blood. I'm gonna have a delve into that.
I love it.
But I really want to get back into my young adult fiction, man. Because I read such heavy technical stuff just on a day to day. If I'm not reading something about psychology or mental health, or you know, I'm training to be a therapist at the moment, yeah, and I'm reading about the, you know, emotionality and kind of what that looks like. And it's such real stuff.
Yeah.
And like, I'm, you know, again, reading biographies and kind of teachings and spirituality things and of that nature. And then you just want to just escape solely to somewhere else completely. And yeah, I might tap back into my Charlie Bone series just to kind of get me going just a little bit.
Love
But yeah, man, I love that stuff.
Oh, I'm glad. So the reason I said it was a really badly put transition was this idea of that you take this love for reading and literature and you take it with you as a university degree where you go and study foreign languages in the Midlands, right, and more specifically, right, Nottingham. Mm-hmm. How did you find that transition up to the Midlands, and what would you say was the most significant lesson you pulled from your time as a student? I say up north. I know that annoys everyone from the Midlands because they're like, no, it's not up north. But
it's the heart of England.
Yeah, it's the middle of the country. Me just, you know, the arrogant London kind of just thinking anything north of us is north. But
I had family in the Midlands. So I'd always grown up there.
Yeah.
It wasn't a foreign idea for me. It wasn't difficult for me to go up there. It wasn't anything. I was just like, oh, this I didn't have family specifically from Nottingham.
Yeah.
But it was nice to think that my family were half an hour away if I needed to go and meet and see them or catch up with them and keep them there. So that was that. But you know, going to languages, I didn't study literature actually. I studied languages and linguistics for like I studied linguistics for the first year, and second year, and then I kind of dropped linguistics, and I just continued with foreign languages, and I did Spanish and French, and within it, I did spend a lot of time in literature, in their literature, and you know, I became a huge fan of Spanish literature.
Ooh.
You know, even Pablo Neruda. I was very interested in the Latin American experience, naturally, being of the Americas. I was just like, oh, okay, so we have the Caribbean. I want to get deep into Latin America. So the Pablo Nerudas, the Gabriel Garcia Marquez kind of stuff, you know, the Juno Diaz Dominican experience and what that means, what that looks like. And you know, and I kind of really started branching out. I did French as well. So I was looking at the Francophone cultures. I read IET by Roxane Gay. And I was really tapping into just these these hybrid experiences of what of parts of the world that had been colonized by the Europeans, and obviously I read a lot of the English Caribbean stuff naturally already, but the French Caribbean stuff, the Marie Scondé, the Patrick Chamoiseau, and all of these guys, I just really just kind of tapped in to it because I felt like, again, it's like what I said about Carnival, it's like it is my birthright. It is the shared and collective experience of what it means to be subjugated by a culture that was not yours.
Yeah.
But yet you are writing a, you're writing a bodies of work in their language, in the language that you have been forced upon you by oppression,
yeah,
and brute force. And that was something that I had to really come to terms with. The very fact that each day I speak English is the reminder of the colonizers' quote unquote success. And it's, and I struggle with that very often, a lot of the time, because I'm just like, because I, you know, I speak patois from the Jamaican patois, and I really kind of tapped into French Creole. And I love learning, and I love the kind of the differences in Latin American and Caribbean Spanish and how they differ. I made a lot of Dominican friends on my year abroad when I was in Spain and things of that nature. But we try to empower ourselves with these languages that our that we had to use and utilize for survival as well. And it really kind of it holds fast on our identity. So I loved studying languages. I loved every moment of it. It was so difficult in places because conjugations are a bitch.
Yeah, right.
But it was good. Like, I really enjoyed the I traveled every other year. I was in a country. I was somewhere.
Yeah.
And I spent 9 months abroad after university teaching English on a French-speaking island. And yeah, I just I really just showed up for myself. Yeah. You know, I was just like, yes, this is kind of, I want to explore more. And again, coming back home, getting into work, working as a journalist, and kind of stuck in London, not necessarily doing the journalism that I wanted to do. I lost a lot of that fire for travel, that fire for exploration. And I think that it was coming back to me in 2020. And I'm glad, kind of, for my own personal sake, it's so selfish at the moment, but I was like, okay, cool. I don't have to go anywhere at the moment. But as soon as this is locked up, as soon as this is done, I can get out and travel to the places I want to travel to.
Yeah.
Because it means so much more now.
Mm.
It's such a different feeling of traveling now. We're going to see people with this intentional need to be away from their home countries.
Yeah.
And I so badly want to go and explore and learn from other places now.
Yeah.
And I even want to explore England and the UK. Like, I was saying this to my uncle this weekend. I want to tap into the UK and really get to know it.
Mm.
I think that's something that we have lost or never even invited to do as people who, of people of color in the country. We've just been excluded from understanding the country that we're in, you know, and especially as Londoners as well. It's this idea of, oh, why go to Cornwall? Why go to Manchester? Why go to Bristol? Why go up north? Why go da 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 da? Why not?
Yeah.
There's so much to see in this country. There's so much history. As much as the history is, you know, wrought with blood and violence and all these different things, there's so many places that we can go. There's amazing coastlines. There's some really quaint, homely villages and towns, and, you know, just with different pieces of culture and environment there. So yeah, I'm just like, there's so much that we can do.
Yeah,
so much that we can do. And I'm just looking forward to being able to just do it.
Yeah.
Without having to worry.
Yeah, there's oh, that's brought up so many nice feelings in terms of, firstly, you speaking with such passion about your degree. It's just really lovely to hear and to have such an enriching experience, and then being able to let that kind of bleed into a career for the, you know, for those 9 months or so afterwards. And yeah, this idea of England, I think as Londoners especially, it's this idea of, you feel like everything's here, and that because it is quite culturally diverse, you don't feel the need to get out of the bubble, as it were. And then, yeah, kind of as I moved away for university, and I remember just being like, this is like a completely different world. It felt so strange. And I only moved to Southampton, and it's not like a great shift culturally, but it was enough to be like, oh God, like it was being slapped in the face of like real, you know, I guess just like cultural like deprivation, this idea of like, oh God, I've really not experienced shit at like 18. I really am just like so much a product of where I've been kind of just born and raised, that yeah, you feel like you get like this itch to kind of, in terms of self-development and just evolution, you feel like you need to experience more. So once again, very much empathize and resonate with me, kind of the way that you spoke about just exploring England. So you do come back and you go into reporting, but alongside your reporting work, you start up a podcast, which is something we definitely have in common. But you've been podcasting since 2016, and a lot's changed over those 5 years. I was wondering, can you speak to what podcasting looks like for you when you were coming up with your podcast at the time, Mostly Lit, which has ended now, but it hasn't ended your journey in podcasting. But no. Can you speak to kind of what it looked like in 2016 and kind of what were your maybe like personal hopes and desires for what you could get out of that kind of that form of media and that platform specifically?
Yeah. At the time, podcasting wasn't a thing. Like, it was YouTube. I listened to a few podcasts that started in 2013, but I had never thought about kind of starting my own podcast until I sat down and I thought to myself, actually, there's this podcast that happens that's in the States, and I wonder if we could do the same, but just for books in the UK. And I ended up just, you know, pitching it to my friend, and we went about and found, you know, a network that would accommodate that. And we had the conversation, and I thought that it was an amazing opportunity just to kind of do something different. I'd always wanted a radio show. I'd always wanted to be on radio and speak. But I never had the opportunity to do that throughout my own experience in journalism. So I thought, okay, take it into my own hands. Let me actually create a space that we can speak and have a conversation. And yeah, so, you know, and at the time it wasn't big. Like, podcasting, people were just like, oh, what's that? That's a bit strange. Da-da-da-da. I think that's become more and more of a, you know, businesses use it for marketing. People, it's so easy to set up a podcast nowadays. The initial costs of it aren't as expensive as you would imagine them to be. It's just, all you've got to do is buy a decent mic and have a decent computer that can record. Even then, have a phone that can record. You have to just believe that what you're doing is good and decent, you know, because ultimately now, at this stage, I was like, you know, we've got all these podcasts now. It's like, how do you stand out? And you also got to keep leveling up and continuing just to be as good as you can be in your space. So, yeah, I mean, the nature of like podcasting now, there's a lot of competition out there, but it's still not as saturated as YouTube and video. But I think it's a key part of the content creating process now. A lot of content creators have a YouTube channel and a podcast, or both together. brands are specifically looking at podcasts to get their message across and out nowadays. Yeah, man, I'm extremely pleased to have been in podcasting for as long as I have, and I continue, and I want it to be go on for as long as I can, as I can make it, to be honest. Because a lot of my key moments in my 20s had to, in my late 20s, mid to late 20s, were to do with the podcasting experience. And I'm extremely grateful. I started podcasting at 24, and I think October will make 6 years of podcasting.
Wow.
So it's been good going.
Yeah, because then you end up starting, at the time it was What Matters, but of course now it's evolved into Time to Talk.
Yeah.
And you hold this like beautiful space for the conversation of mental health, but it's not, it's the umbrella of mental health, but you've done this fantastic job of pinpointing with a specific guest that you're having on that, right, this drilling down and going, right, this part of what mental health conversation is would be very interesting with said person. How have you found just having these really enriching conversations with people from many different walks of life, and now you've just got this massive library of episodes of like these phenomenal conversations with really special people, including yourself, of course, as one of those special people. How does that feel, kind of looking back in a reflective way? I know it's not the end, but being able to reflect on what you've built with Time to Talk.
I am so happy that it's grown in the way it has, and it's growing in the way it's growing, because I always wanted to, after having a book podcast, I thought, you know, like having a book podcast is a lot of work, because we were reading a book a week and I was like, this is really draining and hard. Because you have to read the book a week, you have to dissect it, and you have to then debate it. And then we started again, and it was again, and we went again, again, again. So my thing was always like, I wanted to have the conversations with people about their health. That's where What Matters came up. I wanted to have the conversation with people about their health, and I wanted to be able to really tap into what had made them the best that they could be, you know, people's health and in their workplace, at school, you know, in their projects and stuff. And just over time, I started speaking to a lot more men about their mental health, and it just gradually moved into a space where I could just call it Time to Talk. And my agent said, you should call the book Time to Talk, and you should alter your podcast to do the same. And I said, interesting. Mm. That could be really, really fun. And I said, let's do it. It went from so many different things. It went from the talk. It went talking with. It went for all these different things. But the Time to Talk is a lovely little name for a podcast.
I completely agree. It's cute. It is cute. But it also, it's nice that you've kind of allowed the evolution of the podcast to kind of, it has a very tangible thing that has actually truly evolved with the podcast, which is the name. And as you've mentioned, it is the name of your book. Can you give people an insight into what Time to Talk, the book, is all about? I'm really, really excited that I've managed to get a copy early. But yeah, can you speak to what that book represents in terms of what it is, what the content is, in short? Because I know that time is something we're in consideration of. But also this idea of what it's allowed you to do that maybe the podcast didn't initially, or just it's given you the idea of like having something different to the podcast but aligned with your mission.
The book is a manifesto for healing. It's me saying to men, I see you and I hear you, and I have experienced a lot of this stuff too myself. What are we going to do about it next? It's a manifesto for that. It's exploring what mental health looks like in the wider context of men, it's exploring and kind of sowing the seeds for my wider conversations around emotionality and connectivity. It is conversations with a lot of different men about their own experiences with grief, with self-acceptance, with self-worth, with all of these different things that we experience as men, but we don't speak about.
Yeah.
Friendship, relationships, work, the work-life balance. Not that there's such a thing, but, you know, like it's one of those. Yeah, we have a deep, deep understanding and conversation around that stuff in the book. And it's digestible, you know. You could read that in a day or two. And it's quite like, you know, you just pick and choose which chapters you want to start in. Yeah. And you just go from there. It's lovely. It's a lovely little first book, and I'm so proud of it. And I just hope that it speaks to men and women, and you know, and I hope that they, you know, people who identify non-binary, genderqueer, everybody, different sexualities, different experiences. And I hope that it becomes a place of a source of conversation starting.
I believe it will. You're truly fantastic. The space that you provide with your podcast, and just in general, the traveling platform that you are in terms of what you've provided for men, obviously for myself, that's what I can directly attach to, but also this idea that you've provided this fantastic space for Black men to be open and have the conversation around men's mental health is something that I've really appreciated, being more as a spectator, of course, in that case. So yeah, please go and support Alex. I'm gonna get Alex to plug everything and then ask him the final four questions. So Alex, where can people find more of you, and where can they just access more greatness from yourself?
You can find more of me on Instagram. That's where I reside.
Okay.
It's at by Alex Holmes, by Alex Holmes. And you can go to Vero, where I post a lot of my book recommendations typically. It's Alex Reads over at vero.co/AlexReads. And yeah, I just, where else am I? If you go to alexholmes.co, you can explore the wonders of what I'm creating and what I'm building there. I have a newsletter that I send out each Friday called Feel Good Friday, which explores a short little nugget of emotional resilience, because I haven't really spoken about this today, but I'm an emotional resilient healer and coach. And I work with men, particularly at the moment, about how to, you know, navigate emotional resilience and awareness to kind of deal with the stressful parts of life. A lot of the different conversations I have in the book kind of allude to that. So I work with emotional resilience, and I yeah, so you know, there's the information for quote unquote coaching in there. There's the newsletter there. There's where you can pre-order the book there. There's a different ways you can get in contact with me there. Yeah, and the podcast. Just head over to the podcast, Time to Talk with Alex Holmes, and yeah, you can speak to me about whatever. Have a listen, and drop me a message if you want anything read out on air and stuff. Yeah, so yeah.
Awesome. I love it. I'm a subscriber of the newsletter. It is fantastic. So you've got one recommendation from me there, and I love the podcast. So everything that Alex has plugged is fantastic. So please, please go and support him in whatever way that suits you. Right, Alex, final four questions. These are questions I ask all the guests, and they are questions that are more open and a bit more general. So, question one. If I was to give you a megaphone that spoke to the entire world and you could share only one message, what would it be?
Love one another.
I love it. That's great.
Love one another. I think that's all that needs to be said on that.
Me, yep, completely agree. Question two. What's your biggest personal struggle that not many people know about?
Trusting myself. I have to remind myself daily that I trust myself and believe what I'm doing. The moment we begin to not have trust in ourselves and our decisions is the moment we really give up our power and our understanding of who we are. Trusting myself is one of the most, it's one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. My decisions, decisions in general, whether that be for my work decisions, my exercise decisions, my relationship decisions, my friendship decisions, my conversations that I'm having, the things that I'm really trusting that I'm meant to be having these things, these conversations and doing that has been one of the hardest things. And really learning how to say yes and no and what that means for me.
Yeah. Question number three. What are three personality traits / characteristics that you would say you've built your life upon up to this point?
Being trustworthy. In order to be trustworthy, you have had to have broken trust to understand the gravity of what breaking trust within a friendship, in a relationship, in a family means, even work. So trustworthiness is something that I built up over time. Open-heartedness. You have to have experience being closed off in order for you to understand what it means to be open-hearted. It's so weird, isn't it? Mm. You have to understand the opposite in order for you to be truly the one, the other way.
Completely understand.
And the third personality trait characteristic, curious.
Mm.
Curious. I am very curious about all things. Yeah. Everything I want to know.
Oh, that's awesome.
I want to know. Like, I'm supremely just interested in everything.
Yeah.
There's so much. It's annoying that I have a limited amount of time on this earth because I would want to know everything. I would want to know. I would want to watch every documentary. I want to read as many books as I can. I want to listen to as much music as I can. You know, unfortunately, realistically, that's not possible. But it also kind of informs my life. It means that I never say no to something straight away unless I've already got experience with something of that nature. You know, like I always try, I'm always willing to try something once or twice. So I will always try.
I love it. All three of those are amazing. The final question, it's my favorite question. Many years into the future, your time as Alex Holmes is coming to an end. The person closest to you only has one sentence to describe you and your time here on Earth. What would you hope that would be?
Boy, I love that question. Mm-hmm. It would be, he did his best to make it safe for us.
Mm. Alex, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And just having this conversation with you is something irrespective of microphones, it's just something I've been looking forward to anyway. So thank you very much. I'm really appreciative of it. Everyone, please go check out Alex in whatever way, in terms of he's a man of many talents. So you get a choice in terms of what suits you in the doses of Alex that you get. So please go check out whatever your heart desires in that respect. Right, Alex, let's say goodbye to everyone. Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.